Hello, friends. I'm Rosie Acosta, author, mindfulness teacher, and wellness coach.
And I'm Tessa Tovar, producer, co-host, and your partner in Real Talk for all things wellness and beyond.
Welcome to the Radically Well podcast. This is a space where we break down the messy, transformative moments that make us who we are, because wellness isn't about perfection. It's about embracing the journey.
Every week, we'll tackle the topics no one talks about, but everyone needs to hear, like navigating hormones, aging, relationships, sex, and self-care.
You'll hear unfiltered stories, expert advice, and real, relatable conversations that empower you to reset your mindset, reimagine your health, and show up as your most authentic self. Whether you're here to learn, laugh, or maybe cry a little, this is your space to feel seen, supported, and inspired to live radically well.
So grab your favorite tea or, hey, maybe a glass of wine, and let's dive in.
Let's get radically well. We are so excited to be having this creative conversation with Andrea Bartz, our amazing resident New York Times bestselling author, novelist, creative, amazing woman. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. Are you kidding?
I'm so excited. I'm sweating through my shirt. Okay.
Oh my God, me too. Story of my life right now.
Wow. I'm glad I'm bringing that out in both of you. That's a compliment.
So you've written several novels, and you and I met in 2019?
I think it was 2020, because we both had books coming out around what ended up being the pandemic, right? The lockdown.
Yes. Oh my goodness. That was...
So set the scene. Where did you guys meet? How was this? I wanna visualize.
Oh, so we have a mutual, Jason Pfeiffer, who is a dear friend. And I had just chatted with Jason. I don't remember exactly. He had been on the Radically Loved podcast, but we sort of hit it off, and we just like became friends, and we just like exchanging information. And he had been talking about starting a newsletter, and so we were having this conversation about just like, you know, shop talk. And I told him, he asked me, he always asks such great questions. And he had asked, what are you excited about right now? Like, what are you working on? And I said, well, I have been working on this novel idea for years. At that point, 2020, I think it had been like a year and a half, but it had been amalgamating for a couple of years. And he said, well, I have a really dear friend. You should talk to her because she's a novelist. And I was like, yes, introduce us. And he did. And Andy gave me the best advice to this day. She sent me a list of books that I should read. And she just really gave me the encouragement that I needed to start. Because I had started, but it was like just sort of an outline of this idea and a couple of chapters. It was so non-cohesive. But yeah, she became like my novel godmother.
Aww. That is so nice.
Andy, so you just published another New York Times bestseller, The Last Fairy Out, and I imagine you've been going around.
Definitely not a bestseller, this one. I've had five books come out. One of them was a New York Times bestseller. That one was called We Were Never Here. But the cool thing is, if you're a bestseller once, then they put that on all of your books that the author are a New York Times bestseller.
As it should be. Well, what does it feel like to just keep banging them out? I want to hear about your process, like your creative process, what it feels like to go through writing something like that, what it feels like to finish something like that and then go on tour and, you know, all the things.
Yeah, I feel really lucky to get to keep doing this. Like when Rosie and I were connected, I had one book out, my debut, The Lost Night, and then I had my second book, The Herd, coming out end of March 2020. So it was like, you know, horrific timing in terms of sales, in terms of the world shutting down, in terms of the mail getting messed up, and in terms of everyone's orders getting canceled, the people virtually not having a way to get a book of mine. But I just kept writing. I already had a draft of my third book. And so I sort of poured all my energy into that. And it was really lucky and incredible because that book, We Were Never Here, which came out in 2021, was a Reese's Book Club pick and sold really well. So that sort of allowed me to keep going and keep doing this. And The Last Fairy Out, which came out in paperback on June 16th, so pretty recently, is my fifth book. And I love it. I feel like I face new challenges with every book I write and have a lot of, you know, doubt in the middle of it that I'll actually be able to do it. And I always question, like, is this the one I'm going to have to throw in the towel and return my advance and, like, just pack up and they'll take away my writer card and I'll never write again. But that hasn't happened yet. And I feel like I could never write one of my books without everything I learned from writing the ones that came before. So when people are like, oh, which of your books is your favorite? I'm always like, it's the most recent one because it's the, you know, culmination of so much that I've learned and that I've experimented with and that I could not have done without all of the books that came before it.
You know, one of the things, Andy, I want to just add this because I have read every single one of them. And I could, to me, it's like they're just so amazing and so different. But there's also this like cohesive within the characters that I see, right? So I feel, and by the way, like this, when it first came out on paperback, now available wherever you get your books, I read it like the minute I got it. I think I finished, I may have texted you or tagged you, and I was like, oh my God, it was so good. And I feel like one of the questions I've had for you as you've learned, right, in this process is how have you seen your, first of all, how do you choose your protagonist? That's my first question. And the second question, as you've evolved from your first book to The Last Fairy Out, how has your approach to writing characters changed?
Those are such great questions. And thank you for those kind words. I think in every case, I try to approach figuring out the story and figuring out the character and writing the book with the biggest sense of vulnerability that I possibly can. So I write about messy, complicated women and the messy, complicated relationships that they find themselves in, whether that's within a friend group, a social milieu, whether that's in a relationship, a romantic relationship, whether that's a really kind of codependent best friendship, whatever it is, like I want to bring to it a lot of uncomfortable feelings that we don't like discussing in polite society, especially when it comes to women. So I'm bringing to it my own sort of repressed shame, rage, fear, envy, jealousy, competition, all of these things that like we know everyone experiences, but we really don't like to shine a light on. And I'm just challenging myself whenever there's a choice I can make for a character that makes me uncomfortable to think about writing that or to think about asking a reader to empathize with that and to still be on board with this character. That's the way I go. And hopefully I explain what they're doing and their decisions well enough and their background and why they're like this well enough that they're not just plain like, you know, a villain for no reason. And people can still empathize with them and root for them. But I want my characters to feel real. And for me to bring that to the table, I have to challenge myself to like really go there and really share thoughts that like I probably would not voice aloud or ever put into a memoir as in any way associated with me. And in terms of shaping these characters, I'm kind of figuring out the narrator, who's I write in first person usually, the narrator at the same time that I'm figuring out the story and the plot. I write without an outline. I sort of start with a hook or some interesting like question or scene, and then I write to figure out the story. And, you know, I'm getting to know the character as I'm getting to know the story and as the themes are emerging. And by the time I get to the end of the first draft, I've usually figured out what the theme is, like what I'm trying to say about the right way to live and like the best way to live a life. And so then I'm able to look kind of clearly at my character and figure out like what is the journey that they need to go on? Who is sort of the person least suited to complete this journey and therefore the best suited for us to watch them go through a transformation, learn all the lessons of this book, and come out the other side with a fresh perspective. So that really informs, you know, everything from like their hobbies to what they do for a living to just these details of who they are at the beginning versus who they are at the end.
It's such an intelligent and creative process to me. I'm always in awe when I think about, you know, I'm an avid reader. I love reading. I feel like I always have to have like 3 to 4 books waiting in my stack to be read. Otherwise, I get anxious about what I'm going to read next. So, when I get to like have the pleasure of sitting down with somebody like you, I always just want to pick your brain about how do you create that imaginative storyline? Like, where does that come from? What is your source of inspiration? Do you feel like you were born with it? Is this a skill you developed over the years? Is it a combination of both? Like, can you walk me through that a little bit?
Yeah, I love that question. And I want to hear Rosie's answer too, because I know you have a completed draft manuscript at this point that I have not read yet, but that I've heard the buzz is that it's fantastic. But for me, I grew up as a reader like you. I would go to the library every week and like come home with a huge tote bag full of books and swap it out every week. And as a little kid, I started just trying to emulate them. So I would sort of, you know, write and illustrate my own books and mimic and ape like the kinds of stories that I was reading and how they were written. And I think just in that natural way where like nobody's told a little kid that they can't write a book. So like they're all trying. So if you love a book, you're going to like write a book. Right? That was my creative outlet. And then in college, I discovered journalism, and I kind of forgot about fiction, and I worked as a magazine editor for years. I worked at Glamour and Martha Stewart and Self and Psychology Today and some other places, which I really loved. And I think from that, I honed some writing skills in terms of hooking the reader and in terms of economy of words and sort of what are the few details that are going to make a story really come alive or make a character or a person you're writing about feel real. I definitely learned how to write on deadline, under pressure, which became a really, really relevant skill later on now that I have real deadlines to write books and like due dates that I have to meet. But I think in terms of where the stories are coming from, like I said, there's some beating heart to an idea that I don't totally know how I feel about. So to give an example, The Last Ferry Out is about a young woman who is traveling to this remote tropical island off Mexico where her partner, her fiancé, died in a tragic accident a few months earlier. And while she's there, she meets this really enchanting group of expats who have made this island their home. And they're like, of course we remember your fiance. She was wonderful. They're sort of becoming friends, and she's getting to see that this island really is a beautiful place and it's bringing her comfort until she wakes up one morning to a text from one of the expats that says, "You deserve to know the truth about your fiance. Meet me at the cafe at 9 a.m. And she rushes to meet him, and he has vanished from the island altogether, as far as she can tell. So that was sort of the setup. But I wrapped that setup around my own personal fascination with expats. So in February 2020, when it was fantastic timing, which I didn't know at the time, I spent a month traveling solo through Mexico. And while I was there, I don't really speak Spanish, so everywhere I went, I would find the kind of the local expat community. And it was these just interesting motley crews of people from all over the world, wide range of ages, wide range of backgrounds. All they really seemed to have in common was that they had come to Mexico. They'd parachuted out of their lives for whatever reason. They didn't really talk about why. And they were speaking the same language, and therefore they were really close. And I couldn't figure out, I'm first generation. My mom came from Hungary with her parents when she was a kid. And, you know, my grandparents with their thick Hungarian accent, they were always immigrants. Like nobody considered them expats in the U.S., right? And so thinking about these groups of expats who were so friendly and welcoming, I was like, I love them, but I a little bit hate them and I'm envious of them. But I'm judgmental of them. Well, why am I judgmental of them? I think it's great that they got out of the rat race. Like the capitalistic rat race is bullshit. So why am I so, why do I have so many feelings about this? And I didn't know how I felt about it, which usually to me is a good indication that I can write. It'll power an entire book. And by the time I got to the end, I don't know that I have a firm answer, but I do feel like I have wrestled with it and like can close the book and write the end and like move on from spiraling about it.
I love that answer.
It's such a great answer.
What's your answer, Rosie?
I mean, I don't look. We can have my conversation when, you know, we're in the process of publishing a work. But I agree with Andy and that sort of the framework of character and character development and saying all the things that like you couldn't or don't want to or feel like it gives you an opportunity to be in other people's shoes, right? To have other experiences. And I think that my first book, novel that, so I just finished a second. And I feel like for me, it's more of a cathartic experience to be able to develop a story. And I've been creative writing since I was a child. I mean, like since I was 6 years old. And I love what you said, Andy, about like when you're little, like nobody tells you you can't do anything. So you just have the gall, right? And the tenacity to just be confident and just do something. And I feel like, to be honest, that's really what you gave me back with your guidance, right? And giving me the sort of freedom of just writing. You're like, just write. Like that was what you said. You're like, just write it. Like, don't, you know, because I would get too in the weeds about a premise or a plot or, you know, having something be grammatically correct and things making sense. And it took a long time for me to feel that confidence. And I think it took some time, but to your point, and you know, going back to Abby, the main protagonist, right, in The Last Fairy Out, I feel like for me, every character you've had, you know, it's like, to me, I feel like there are certain characters that really speak to that part of us that wants expression, right? And so I think using that as your framework for creativity really helps in developing a story that resonates with people, that creates this like thrilling experience of, you know, wanting to continue. And again, like this one for me did that. And it could have been too, like when I got it, I was like, oh my God, like what is she doing now? Like, who is this person? And yeah, so I feel like I don't want to give too much framework for people because I feel like the women that are listening to this know that Tessa and I love reading. I mean, we love this genre so much. And I think that the main takeaway for me in this and just in you, Andy, as a writer, is the freedom that you've given the reader to go along with the story that is very real and very authentic, you know? And yeah.
You, Andy, you spoke to this a little bit earlier. I think you were kind of needling around this idea of like there being a message or a learning in your protagonist or in the story itself. And I always think about when I was little and I was reading a lot of my parents always let us listen to like Grimm's fairy tales, which were, or like like Clarissa Pinkola Estes, my I had that book in my hands when I was a little kid. So I was like, there was a lot of myth and kind of like darkness that went with the lightness that was very, you know, there was something for me to glean from that. There was like some sort of life lesson. And I think that your characters seem to go through something that needs to be learned, but with this like sort of mysterious, ethereal veil over it. And I mean, you're obviously like really into writing like thrillers and mystery and stuff like that. So I'm wondering, what is it about that genre that pulls you so much? And
yeah, it's funny because people will often ask something like, well, what do you hope readers will take away from your book? And I'm always like, well, obviously, the number one thing is that I want them to be entertained. I want it to be a fun 8-hour experience for them. This is a mystery. I want them to feel like they can't put it down. I want them to finish it and immediately want their friend to read it so they can talk about it. Like, fun is way up there. And I think that this genre is just unmatchable for it. I love a, you know, propulsive mystery, a question of who done it or are they going to get away with it or whatever it is. And to have that, the kind of puzzle element of it, like I described The Last Fairy Out as sort of a puzzle box thriller where you have a few different timelines and perspectives and pieces, you know, puzzle pieces coming together. So for it to be entertaining is one of the top priorities for me. But at the same time, I think every good story, and this isn't just like myths or, you know, Bible stories where there's a very clear, you know, then this is how you must be. I think good stories explore the human condition and the lessons that we have all learned and the best way to live. And I can't remember which one of you it was, but one of you said something about getting to live another life by reading or by writing, right? And getting to experience the empathy of going through, in the case of a thriller, like a really trying time through the eyes of a character who's not you. And I think that forced empathy is so needed right now. Like, storytelling has always been a crucial part of the human existence, right? Since time immemorial, but especially right now, especially when we can all be in our little bubble universes, hearing our echo chambers of only hearing stuff that reinforces what we believe, when literally people are spending hours, you know, dialoguing with a chatbot whose primary goal is to be sycophantic and to back up whatever you believe and to agree with you. That is the opposite of creating empathy, of experiencing conflict, of experiencing things that'll make you uncomfortable. And that's what books can do through sort of the Trojan horse of a really entertaining story, right? So I think of it as almost this sacred duty as an author that I get to be up in people's imaginations, that I get to build those shoes that they're going to step into as readers, or those eyes that they're going to look out as a reader and experience something different and consider things from a different perspective. It's just such a crucial skill. It's also a one-way medium where people have to just, even if they disagree, even if they don't like what the character did or they don't like what's happening, they have to sit with it because they can't just type in, no, tell it a different way. You know, it's not interactive, and that's really good for us and our brains. And that's so good for us and our humanity. And that's why I love that you guys love books, and thank you for all you do to be, you know, encouraging readers out there to pick one up or pick up an audiobook if you're not sure that, you know, sitting and reading on a page is going to be for you. And I think there's so much to be gained for our attention, for our empathy, for our humanity from people reading novels. I don't remember what your original question was anymore.
This is so great, because I want to go back to the social component of it. I mean, not just like how important reading is, but reading queer characters as well, like reading this sort of social context to it. I feel like that historically has been our way to empathize and to relate to other people, right? And in a time where so many books are getting banned and getting, you know, this sort of stigma around it, it's very sad to me that, first of all, that that's happening. But I do find it to be such still a great medium for us to connect and to communicate with people that aren't like us, right? That are different, have different backgrounds. You know, it's like my protagonist in my, and I'm doing air quotes because I'm just still like, you know, in that very starting phase, like you write what you know, right? And it's like, I have characters that have Hispanic lineage, you know, and how their experience interact with the world, you know, and to me, just the thought of having somebody that's not a Hispanic woman read it and have that experience is like, it's so beautiful and it's so exciting and it's so magical, right? And it, I think it really creates a different perspective and a different type of connection and understanding. So in saying that, for you, like writing these characters, what is that like for you? And what has been your reception with your readers?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And, you know, I'm a queer author, and not all of my books center queer characters, but some of them do. And what I wanted to do with The Last Fairy Out was I wanted to center a queer relationship, because it is about sort of this woman's love story with her now lost fiance. But it's not about the fact that they're queer. It's not about the fact that they're a lesbian relationship. So the entire story would work pretty much the same way if it were, you know, a straight relationship. And they have relationship problems, and they have a lot about the relationship that's beautiful. And we get to kind of see it in dual timelines. We go back and we get to see this couple together and see them working through things and having conflict. And it's not a sexy book. There's not, you know, queer sex, which there was some in my book before it, The Spare Room. And I know that was a turnoff for some and a turn on for others.
I loved it.
Thank you. It's not that spicy, but I think because it was queer sex, people really, really were like a little, the pearl clutchers had some thoughts.
Clutching the pearls. As a result, if you're not getting people to clutch their pearls, I don't know what you're doing.
That's amazing.
A little uncomfortable. But for The Last Fairy Out, I thought, let's make you uncomfortable, not because there's queer sex that you need to have feelings about, but just a queer relationship. Let me demonstrate to you that it is no different from any other relationship. The same way that I, as a queer author, am just a person who happens to love, I'm bi, love both men and women, but that doesn't make me scary. That doesn't make me somebody you need to be intimidated by. That doesn't, you know, if you can like and relate to me as a person, then like, congrats, you have a queer friend now. And I mean, for us, it feels silly, but I grew up in conservative suburban Milwaukee. I don't know that my parents know any other queer people. Like, I don't think that that's part of their worldview. And there's lots of people reading books who maybe are within communities where that's not common, or there aren't people who are out or whatever. And so I think just art has such a, you know, popular culture has such a role to play in just introducing, yeah, lives that are unlike your own and identities that are unlike your own. And again, we talked about that empathy piece, like being able to experience the empathy of, well, what is life like if you have, you know, Latina heritage? What is life like if you are a normal working person just like me, but you happen to have a partner who is the same gender as you? And if we can sort of normalize that stuff and get people to begin to see themselves in characters that are unlike themselves, I think that would be really, really great for our sort of empathy-starved society these days.
Yeah, so true. I'm curious, I was reading in your bio, this kind of is an adjacent topic, about being involved in the class action lawsuit, Barts versus Anthropic, which is, I won't say much about it because I'm not privy to it, but I'd love to hear you talk about. It was a major creative win against an AI company.
Yeah, yeah. So I got involved in this lawsuit years ago. It was not the first copyright lawsuit. It was not, put it this way, it was not the first time that authors had sued an AI company for infringing on their copyrights by essentially downloading pirated copies of their books, pirated ebooks, and then feeding those into an algorithm to train their AI, you know, algorithm, their chatbot. So there had already been several lawsuits, and I had reached out to some of the law firms and been like, I want to be involved. I'm really fired up. I could see that my books were, you know, among those being sort of gobbled up without consent nor compensation. And then somebody high up at Anthropic, which creates Claude, had told a journalist that they had used one of these data sets. And so the law firm reached out and was like, we are going to put together a class action lawsuit about this copyright issue. Would you potentially be interested in being a lead plaintiff? And so I decided to put my privilege where my mouth is and step into the fray and open myself up to a lot of work, to a lot of invasive discovery requests. They had, lawyers had full access to all of my emails and texts and DMs and everything else. And I was like, well, thank God I don't sext. And years of work. But what was really exciting was that it culminated in a settlement with Anthropic that is a $1.5 billion settlement for as copyright damages for about 500,000 works, books that were included in that data set that they downloaded and stole and fed into their algorithm. And so it's the first major win for creatives against an AI company. Hopefully the first of many. There's lots of lawsuits still worming their way through the, you know, working their way through the courts. And it's also the largest copyright settlement in the history of copyright law. So that's very exciting. So it's, you know, a first corrective step. I don't by any means think this is the end of the battle. I think this is just, it was really important that we get a win so that we can continue creating these guardrails and consequences for AI companies that until this point have sort of operated with, you know, no guidelines, no restrictions whatsoever, total carte blanche. So I hope that it is a trend that moves in the right, you know, moves us in the right direction. That said, I'm at the point now where I the copyright stuff is really important. It's really important that artists, you know, be able to continue making a living and not just have their work stolen and dumped into algorithms that will mimic them and ape their work. But I think the biggest issue facing us now is generative AI and society as it exists, not as it was trained. So I'm always encouraging people to really think hard about your own AI use. It is sucking up our fresh water. It is enriching billionaires who are some of Trump's biggest donors. It is ruining the environment. It is demonstrably hurting our empathy, our critical thinking, our attention spans. And so I'm very anti-generative AI in general. But it was exciting and an honor that I got to be involved in this kind of landmark case that has to do with what happened, you know, 5-6 years ago when they were first starting to sort of build these, you know, alien intelligences, these AI models that they don't even totally understand, which is really, really frightening to me.
Yeah, you have a great piece that you wrote on your Substack, Andrea Bartz, Get It Right. And I was just, I can't even remember. I sent it to like so many people. It was such a great, great piece. And it was a collaboration you did with another writer, I believe.
I think it was just me. I did two pieces that both started a lot of conversation. And one, the headline was "Why I'm Against the Use of Generative AI Altogether," and then I followed it up with one that was something like 7 ways that I'm resisting generative AI or ways I'm trying to reduce my usage. And you know, they're not comprehensive, and maybe there's some things I would say differently now, even a few months after I wrote it. But I just needed to put this stuff out there that like people, because people weren't thinking about it. They were like, no, but it makes it so easy to plan a trip or to do
the itinerary, to make an itinerary. Yeah.
I get that. I absolutely agree that there are great use cases, but are any of them worth it for the trade-off? I don't think so. And it's really dangerous for us to just ignore the trade-off because it's easy.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I highly recommend. So if you're watching this on YouTube or if you're listening to this, we will add those links so that you can read on the info below. Sorry. Tessa's like, right, you can, if you're watching this on YouTube, just look at the description and the links will be there. Andy, you have been so generous with your time with us here on the podcast, but also just with me in general with my endless questions that I randomly text you. So thank you so much for that. Is there anything else that you want to add to this conversation that we didn't cover?
Yeah. I mean, thank you so much for everything that you do, everything that you have done for me in my books and everything that you are doing for just a community and instilling a love of books and reading in the community. One thing I would say is that people don't always realize two things. If there's a book that you're interested in and you walk into your local bookstore and they don't have it, they will 100% order it for you for free, no charge, and they'll let you know when it's there. Often you can also just request it on their website. And so just know that, like, it's a really incredible way to support your local bookstore. And even if you can't give up Amazon altogether, a bookstore, just books, just this one category, it's so good for everyone, for the author, for the world, if you can be buying books from ideally an independent bookstore, but at least not from Amazon. And another thing is, a lot of people don't realize that if you request a book from a library, even if you decide not to check it out, but if you request it from a library, especially in all its forms, I want audiobook, I want ebook, now I want paperback, because now paperback is out in addition to hardcover. That is so, it costs you $0, and that is so helpful to the author, because libraries will order it in different formats. They actually pay more because they have to license an audiobook or an ebook. So they pay more than the average user to do that. But even for physical copies, the more people that are requesting this book or putting a hold on it or getting added to the holds list, the more copies that they will get. And so it's free to you, but so, so helpful to an author. So any author out there, it's getting harder and harder to make a living, and AI is really going to challenge the publishing industry and challenge our ability to keep producing books. So if you have a favorite author whose work you love, it's incredible if you can pre-order their book, buy their book, especially from an indie bookstore. But also, if money is an issue, it's really powerful to request it from your local library.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. Go ahead, Rosie.
No, you go. You go.
I was just going to say, I've been doing that. I stopped ordering books on Amazon. I think it's been about a year now. I remember just making this pact with myself. Like, there's no reason I can't. Because the reason why I started doing this is because we finally got an independent bookstore in little old Vancouver, Washington, that I wanted to support. And it's like right down the street from my house. And I just really want them to do well and survive. So I was like, why am I ordering these books on Amazon when I can literally just go down the street? I get to meet local, retail people and authors. And I had that experience where I was looking for something and they were like, oh, we can get that in for you. So I would leave the listeners, the audience, with a little challenge, maybe just like set a goal of 30 days, 60 days or something to do what Andy just suggested and not choose that one category, not order any books from Amazon, and try to go out to your local bookstore. Ideally independent, if you can. In the Pacific Northwest, we got Powell's, but I know Powell's, over in New York, woo! You've got the Strand.
But you can get Powell's online.
Yeah, you totally can. Yeah,
they'll deliver. Oh,
it's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, that's it. That's it for me.
Yes. Yeah. And thank you so much for saying that, Andy. And again, thank you so much for your time and for your talent and for sharing your stories with us. It really does make a huge difference, I think, for us to be able to go into a different world, to have a different experience, and to just connect to characters and to creativity in a different way. I feel like we need more of that. From what I'm aware of, AI still cannot write like this and still cannot make stories like this and cannot give us the type of heart and authenticity that books like this bring. So for everybody that's listening, if you are a lover of books and a lover of creativity and you want to support, please do everything we ask. Just listen to us and share this, or share this podcast, share this book with your friends, start a book club. Like, we love hearing about people's book clubs. With the former podcast we have, we would do like a little, you know, suggested readings test. Remember, we need to bring that back. And hopefully this is our attempt of incorporating this into the Radically Well podcast, especially for season 3. Please help support. It is so much work and effort to do this career, to have this career. It takes a lot of passion and a lot of work. And I think a way that we can support our creatives so that they don't just like vanish is to, you know, do what we can to support the arts. Start with your local bookstore. So thank you so much again, Andy. Where can people reach you to connect with you?
Yeah. Thank you again for that push. And I just want to say too, like, yeah, it's a little more expensive to buy a book from not Amazon. Usually Amazon has deep discounts, and that's because it's, you know, screwing over the vendors behind them. So if you find value in the work and in somebody spending years of their life writing a book so that you can get, you know, 8 hours of entertainment out of it, I hope if you are in a position to do so, it's worth the additional like $7 to get it from a bookstore. And if not, there's libraries, and libraries, you know, love to provide books for free, and that's where your taxes go. So support your libraries too. But as you mentioned, I have a Substack that's both author news, but primarily all about the publishing industry, how to break into it. I have interviews with authors. I have craft tips. I have my own sort of pulling back the veil, speaking, being very vulnerable and talking about all of the less shiny sides of being a full-time author. And that is andybartz.substack.com, A-N-D-I-B-A-R-T-Z. It's called Get It Right, W-R-I-T-E. I'm on Instagram and sort of Threads and sort of TikTok at Andy Bartz. I have a Facebook page. It's Andrea Bartz Author. I don't tend to it too much, but it does exist. But then primarily, yeah, you can pick up any of my books wherever books are sold. And as we said, if they're not there, you can certainly order them. So you can let your local bookseller know about The Last Fairy Out. It's F-E-R-R-Y, not fairy, like with two wings. That's a great thing too for the author, because now there's a new bookseller who has it on their radar and maybe is going to check it out for themselves and start hand selling it. So there's a whole cascade of positive effects and dominoes that result from you wandering into your local community bookstore and introducing yourself and telling them what you're excited to read.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. So The Last Fairy Out is out on paperback. And for the first 10 people that post this or respond to this podcast, we're giving away 10 copies purchased from local book sources. So please just comment below The Last Fairy Out and you can get a copy mailed straight to you. So thank you all so much again for listening, for being here, for being a part of our community. We hope that this served you in some way. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thank you all so much. Tessa and I love you all so much. Thank you for being here. We will see you back here soon.
Hugs and kisses, everyone. Bye.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Radically Well podcast. This podcast is produced by Rosie Acosta and Tessa Tovar. Production by Sapphiris Media. Music by Monogram Sound. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.